Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, everybody. Welcome into an all-new episode of Can We Please Talk podcast. As always, I am Mike Leon.
And I'm Nick Saveri.
On the program today, a sad day last week in the United States as one of the oldest bridges in the country was struck by a cargo ship entering the port of Baltimore. Nick and I will discuss this horrible accident that happened, the current state of the investigation, the loss of life, and the measures taken by those to save others who were driving over the bridge that fateful night. If you didn't see that video, I mean, it's a terrible video. We'll be talking about it. Plus, later on the program, Representative Glenn Ivey, who actually represents Maryland's 4th District in the U.S. House of Representatives, just about an hour south of this bridge collapse. He's going to join us, discuss the latest of what he's hearing from local and state officials around the bridge collapse. Plus, we'll get into some other political matters surrounding immigration, the TikTok bill ban, Marjorie Taylor Greene's plan to oust Speaker Johnson, all of that and more with Representative Ivey in just a bit. A really cool conversation. Yet another member of Congress, Nick, coming on the podcast to chop it up with us, as the kids would say. But also, you know, he gave us some takes on the matter surrounding his constituents, the state he reps. I mean, how apropos that we had him on the program. So just that interview with Representative Ivey in just a bit. First, before I say hello to Nick Saveri, an all-new episode of the Educate US podcast is out there now. You can go listen to that wherever you get your pods over on leonmedianetwork.com. Nick and Stacy, welcome in. Kathleen Goulding, she's a co-founder of the URI Education Project, helps educators tell a more complete narrative of history. That's the goal of this organization. They build coalitions, understanding across diverse communities. The org helps schools design curriculum with a focus on Asian American history. You can go check out that conversation. Pretty cool combo, by the way. I was listening to the episode the other day that you guys had with Kathleen. So go check, So go check that out over on leonmedianetwork.com or listen wherever you get your pods. And also, an all new episode of Back Your Play with Q is out there. You can go listen to it on leonmedianetwork.com or wherever you get your pods. This past week, a great interview. He had Hall of Fame baseball writer for USA Today, Steve Gardner, on the program to discuss the LA Dodgers gambling scandal involving outfielder Shohei Ohtani, the fallout from his interpreter being fired for allegedly stealing $4.5 million. But the story keeps changing. What do Steve and Rich think? You can go find out with an all-new episode of Back Your Play with Q over on leonmedianetwork.com, or you can go watch it. Type in Rich Q on YouTube, and you can go watch the interview as well. Steve's got a Hall of Fame vote, Nick. He's in the Baseball Writers Association of America Hall of Fame. There's no one better to break down that story. You and I couldn't even do that. You know, we're not subject matter experts. I don't got a Hall of Fame vote. You don't have a Hall of Fame vote. That was a really good episode. So shout out to Rich and Steve for coming on his pod, because there's a lot to that story. And you and I have touched on, once the investigation process plays out in this, you and I may discuss it a little bit as well, because the premier athlete in a sport potentially being involved in a gambling scandal, that is front page headlines. Now I say hello to Nick. Nick, you know, there's so much news today. We're going to do the bridge collapse in our first segment, because I feel it's important to talk about this, but there's so much news out there. I was thinking about this. First off, P. Diddy, the rapper's houses got raided by HSI, which I did not even know was an investigation unit for Homeland Security until last week. I did not know this. You know, we've had FBI special agents on. We've had DOJ people on. I didn't even know that there was another three-letter agency that does investigations like this. You got the former president out there selling Bibles that have the Constitution in them. That's crazy. I've never seen that before in my life, but the man also sold steaks in a sharper image. So who knows? Then you've got the wars that are still playing out, and they're like not being as covered as much. They're not dominating, as we like to say in TV, the A and B blocks. They're dominating the C and D blocks. So you still got hostages, Israeli hostages, 150 or so in Gaza. We've got no update. Bibi Netanyahu's having surgery. So nobody from the Israeli press has at least been doing television to tell us about the hostages. You still have the bombing in Gaza. and millions, you know, not millions, thousands of kids and adults, you know, being killed in Gaza. And then you have what's happening in Ukraine and the war and, you know, between Russia and Ukraine, Vladimir Putin being president again and, you know, his elections. And I'm using air quotes for those of you watching on YouTube. There's so many different news topics out there. How are you doing first and foremost? What do you make of all of that? That mumbo jumbo I just said there of all those topics. We could have literally started the show with anything. How are you doing, by the way?
No, I'm good. You know, I got some helpful insight on what was going on in Baltimore with the bridge collapse. Obviously, we're going to talk about that coming up. But my friend Virginia, who's down there, was just sending me, you know, I reached out to her, A, to make sure that, you know, her and her loved ones are okay. But then B, you know, we got into a conversation of what is the impact on the community of that bridge. And she had shared, you know, what over the course of the morning, more things that came up for her about, you know, what is the fallout of that? So it's funny, as you were talking about the situation, I mean, what's going on in Gaza right now, you know, I think like many people, I've come to the point where I'm not having this conversation now. I'm having it with less and less people. You know, there are some friends of mine who are not like, they're very set in like what they view the situation as. I tend to place myself not necessarily entrenched in another view, but willing to sort of hear, you know, really differing views on this. And unfortunately, I've reached the point where, you know, those who are just who have the most adamant takes on this are people I just tend to avoid with this conversation. Like, I'll just move in other places because it brings something out of me, like this automatic feel of there are other perspectives here. You know, so when I have folks that talk about, well, bring the hostages home, like there's a part I can't stop myself to say, yeah, but that can't excuse people dying right now. Right. I've actually used the analogy that you shared with me that you heard from someone else of, you know, were this a school shooting, you know, would the solution really be to just like bomb the school, right? Right. Or school hostage situation. Sorry. So I sit with that a lot because, you know, you have that moment where you find of now start to sort of pick and choose. Like it's almost like using the formula at Pardon the Eruption, but you change the list depending on the people you talk to. And ideally with your closest friends, that really shouldn't be the case, but there has always been something about this particular matter in the Middle East that, you know, depending on how diverse your friend group is, you'll get some pretty staunch opinions. And yeah, I've come to the point within the last probably week or so where some people are so deeply entrenched that it's, you know, really playing a role in, you know, their political stances. And that's fine. I mean, I respect where everyone's coming from, but if we're not going to have an informed conversation where we're recognizing that, you know, while October 7th is something that is still now being addressed, the answer can't just be unilaterally what we have right now. And if we can't have that as a conversation, if there's no way to exchange ideas around it without one person feeling as though, well, this is the only way I can see it, it just seems fruitless for me to have that conversation. I feel like you've had moments like this too, play out on social media.
Yeah. I mean, we had somebody wrote into our show. It's visible. You can go check it out on our Instagram page. Follow us over at Can We Please Talk podcast on Instagram, on TikTok, on Twitter at Can We Please Talk. And, you know, it was a college friend of mine, and, you know, just kind of like a back and forth. I mean, I put something pretty funny that was kind of like, hey, you could have just texted me all this as opposed to writing it on our social media page. But it is true. Like this nuanced conversation is kind of lost. And I think I would encourage people, and she's coming back on the program, Layla Molana Allen, who came on PBS special correspondent that was stationed out in Tel Aviv. And she's done a lot of reporting from the region. She came on a few, I think about maybe what, 6-7 weeks ago, whenever you were on vacation, and she filled in for you. And it was her episode that, you know, got a lot of ire and a lot of people with their talking points. Some of them are friends of ours from college, Nick, that will listen to this program. And, you know, it's intellectual laziness for you to just blanket everything with this huge blanket of anti-Semitism. Like you, just like Bernie Sanders said, again, I'm not Jewish, so I don't have a dog in the fight. I'm Puerto Rican. I don't care. Right. Like I have no dog in this fight. But, and I hate even using that phrase because dog in the fight makes it sound wrong. But Bernie Sanders was the one that said it. And I could do my Bernie Sanders impression here, but I won't. or maybe I will, to make some levity. But he basically said, it is not anti-Semitic to be critical of an Israeli government. Like, it's just not. It's not. It's like, you can be critical of something without being anti-Semitic. We sometimes throw that around a little too much, but there's been a lot in the news. You know what? I mean, we can't brighten it up because of this bridge collapse, but I do want to get into the bridge collapse because it's incredibly important to, you know, shipping. Like, this port is a major, major port. And I want to get into a little bit of what happened last week, the rescue and recovery efforts that are ongoing right now. Obviously, it was first search and rescue, and now it's just recovery as a 213 million pound cargo vessel, Nick, last week slammed into the Francis Scott Key Bridge. Happened, at, I think, at around 1:40 in the morning. For people that haven't seen the bridge cam, or I think there was a camera like across the waterway from it that kind of showed the cargo ship's lights kind of losing power, and it's signaling. There's been audio records sent in of the cargo ship's captain calling to say, hey, evacuate the bridge, close the bridge. You know, you can see cars as they were showing this video across TV outlets everywhere. And cars were kind of flying across the bridge because, you know, it's 1:20 in the morning, but not as much traffic as you would get during the day. And the bridge and the cargo ship ended up, it looked like, kind of making a sharp right and hitting, you know, one of the pillars of the bridge. The bridge collapsed all throughout. It killed, unfortunately, six construction workers who were, you know, all working, you know, the night shift to kind of repair the bridge. I want to play a little bit of what the governor said in the immediate aftermath and how he talked about the investigation process and how it's ongoing. So here's Governor Wes Moore.
This morning, our state is in shock. And I want to take this moment to speak directly to the people of our state. To our first responders, I'm in awe of you. I'm in awe of your courage. I'm in awe of your strength. I'm in awe of everything you do for each and every one of us. You saw a crisis, and you said, what can I do to help? And our response teams are doing everything in our power to rescue and recover the victims of this collapse, literally as we speak. Many of us are scared right now. And so I want to be very clear about where everything stands. We are still investigating what happened, but we are quickly gathering details. The preliminary investigation points to an accident. We haven't seen any credible evidence of a terrorist attack. Our administration is working closely with leaders from all levels of government and society to respond to this crisis, and not but just by addressing the immediate aftermath, but also by building a state that is more resilient and a state that's more safe.
Kind of some important things that he just said right there at the end. Investigations ongoing. Not a terrorist act. We're going to get into a little bit of that in just a second, Nick, because there's a lot of people on social media giving their takes about, you know, how this could be something terroristic related. It is not, again, according to preliminary reports, like the governor said there. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg recently just said about $60 million in emergency relief funds are going to be funneled through the Department of Transportation to kind of, you know, help with the reconstruction of the bridge. You know, there's about 10 to 15,000 workers that work there, you know, on the docks, working in the transportation industry within the port. So a lot of jobs are at stake. The president also said the same thing. As a matter of fact, let's take a listen to what the president said. I believe it wasn't in the Oval Office. It was in whatever room that he always gives like pressers to reporters. He said this last week to them. Take a listen.
Our prayers are with everyone involved in this terrible accident and all the families, especially those waiting for the news of their loved one right now. I know every minute in that circumstance feels like a lifetime. I just don't know. It's just terrible. We're incredibly grateful for the brave rescuers who immediately rushed to the scene and to the people of Baltimore. I want to say we're with you. We're going to stay with you as long as it takes. And like the governor said, you're Maryland tough, you're Baltimore strong, and we're going to get through this together. And I promise we're not leaving. Here's what's happening now. The search and rescue operation is our top priority. Ship traffic in the Port of Baltimore has been suspended until further notice. and we'll need to clear that channel before the ship traffic can resume. The Army Corps of Engineers is on the spot and is going to help lead this effort to clear the channel. The Port of Baltimore is one of the nation's largest shipping hubs, and I've been there a number of times as a senator and as a vice president. It handles a record amount of cargo last year. It's also the top port in America for both imports and exports of automobiles and light trucks. Around 850,000 vehicles go through that port every single year. And we're going to get it up and running again as soon as...
You know, I'm very familiar with the bridge. I've driven over it a bunch. You know, obviously it connects with 695. And so now a lot of the traffic in Baltimore, for people that are trying to go a little bit further south, will now funnel through the tunnels. So that's going to be a huge traffic impact for people there. But like you just heard the president say, the biggest issue now is when is the port, obviously the loss of life, a number one. Number two, you got to get rid of all of the debris and the wreckage that is happening right now, that is undergoing right now through federal agencies. There was a report the other day, I believe there's about 3,000 to 4,000 tons of mangled wreckage that extends about 50 feet deep into the channel. This was according to a CNN report with some officials that were at the site. So that is a lot of, you know, a lot of debris. And there's been some talk also that now in the interim, that other ports will obviously start to get some more pickup and traffic from this. You heard the president say there about how big this port is in terms of how much import and exports go out through it throughout the year. A lot there, but there's also been some pushback we've heard recently. And again, we just mentioned this before, that Congress is on a break right now. They're on recess, and we're going to have a member of Congress on in just a bit. So there hasn't been as much chatter about this with the House and Senate, you know, back in its chambers. But there's been some senators going and making the TV rounds talking about how the federal government shouldn't have to pay for this. And one of them was Florida Senator Tim Scott, who happened to be on Fox News Sunday this past weekend with Shannon Bream. And he said this.
But I want to start here with the bridge and us just talking with Governor Moore. There is talk that some of this will have to come through a funding package in Congress, where you guys are fighting over a lot of things. Do you see that moving?
Well, first off, my heart goes out to everybody that lost their life, and I hope they found, the bodies. I feel sorry for those families, and I know it's going to take a lot of work. Look, this should be an issue that we all come together. Unfortunately, the Biden administration has played politics. I still have Florida farmers from a hurricane a year and a half ago that still aren't getting relief. So the federal government is a partner. The federal government needs to be a partner, but we need to stop playing politics, and that's exactly what the Biden administration has done.
Sometimes the jokes write themselves. The man says the Biden administration's playing politics. When you just heard what the former president said about the efforts that need to undergo to save the jobs that are around this port, to reconstruct, you just heard it. And then he says that the Biden administration, with a straight face, is playing politics. Some things are not an R&D thing. Like, you heard both of them back to back. Are my ears bad, or is it that I'm off here? Let me turn to you first, Nick, because again, you know, this collapse here, and just like you were mentioning before about one of your friends living in the area, I have a few family friends that live in the Baltimore, you know, Maryland area, obviously. And so up there all the time, obviously CNN is located, you know, about an hour and change south of that. So I drive up through when I go back to Jersey to see family and friends. So I'm always in Baltimore, like, and I know exactly where this is, a famous scene in The Wire with the bridge, for those of you out there who are Wire fans. You know, this is terrible to see what happened. Shout out to, you know, like the governor was mentioning, some of the first responders and the bridge. I forget what the position title is, but the person that when the captain phoned in, they shut down the bridge on time. We're able to get police squad cars on both sides of the bridge to shut it down. So nobody was driving across when this happened. The only two cars that were on the bridge were the maintenance workers that happened to be working on the bridge. And two of them actually survived. I'm not sure if you've heard the story about one of them refusing medical treatment after he landed in the water. He swam to the shore and he was like, no, I'm just going to go home. One of the craziest stories. I would encourage people to go check out that story. But two survived, six unfortunately lost their lives in this. So shout out to the first responders that were doing that. But What'd you make of the collapse, what you just heard there from President Biden, from Governor Wes Moore, and then from Senator Rick Scott, and how we may already see some games being played in Congress around this?
Just point of order. Is this Senator Rick Scott, Florida?
Correct.
Okay. This is the same guy who also managed to lose all that money for the Republicans when he was head of the like Senate Republican Committee for Fundraising. I believe that's the same Rick Scott.
I believe that is correct, sir.
Yeah. Okay. So I think regardless of political affiliation, I think anytime we look at the federal government's role in providing some form of funding to aid a state in crisis, it's ridiculous when someone comes forward and says, well, we shouldn't do that. Now, I didn't really get that necessarily from Senator Scott's comments, but I have seen it in other places, where members of Congress are just criticizing the president. And I'm wondering what they're criticizing for, to say something like, well, he's playing politics. I mean, we've just had the bridge collapse. Like, what exactly do you all want the turnaround to be for either A, money to go there, or B, for a decision to be made to not spend money? That's what I'm lost on. It just seems like cheap political talking points. Like, at some point, can we get to a place where we, regardless of your political affiliation, we recognize the role of the federal government, unless you're some brain dead libertarian that doesn't think we should be spending money on any of this stuff? Can we at least get to a place where we recognize, like, yeah, we need to do something? Like, either the state of Maryland has to address this, which they're going to, but this is what you have FEMA for. This sounds like, to me, an emergency situation, right? So it's just weird to me, especially, from someone from the state of Florida has had numerous situations where they need federal relief. Like, stop. You just sound dumber every time you talk about this. I'm not sure what to make of it. I don't, in terms of like the reaction. All we know is that we have a bridge that's no longer there. The thing I've been sitting with the most is that just the concept of replacing the bridge. Bridges are one of those constructs that when you drive over or you see off in the distance, you have to recognize how much work goes into the construction, development, planning, and everything of this. And every day we don't get that bridge repaired and back up is a day of lost revenue. It's a day that the port in Baltimore loses its prominence as a major port, where we basically can have like the foundation of getting, goods and services, goods to other people. So I just sit there and I'm so jaded with American industry these days that I look at that, I'm like, well, how long is that going to take? Because when it was built, I imagine there was probably a lot less legality and other issues to get it up and going. Nowadays, it seems like any form of major American production, and I say this as someone who has, ridden the subways in New York City, who has, lived not far, from Hoboken, where it seems to take forever for any of these things to get fixed. We still had subways by the time I stopped traveling mostly to New York for work, and this is like in 2020, that still we're having flooding going through the subway tunnel, issues from Sandy still not resolved. Do I trust our government to get this right now? I really don't. But does that mean I don't think funding should go to them? Of course not. That's stupid. So I just hope that we can get this together quickly, and to the people who lost their lives, the people who their families, this is just tragic. And then you kind of center on the why. Like, what happens in that moment where there's just this huge screw up and you just have, a ship just basically just take a bridge down, which, by the way, isn't the only time it's happened recently. It's actually a similar situation just took place in Arkansas. The bridge doesn't completely come down, but you do have a barge that hits one of the foundations. So clearly something may be happening here. You'll notice that Mike and I are not going down the road of otherwise, like, I'm simply asking aloud, how could this have happened? Unfortunately, in this 24-hour landscape, in this blogosphere, whatever, people are going to fill that gap with their own explanations. And that's where things start to get scary.
I'm so glad you said that, man. What a, you're putting it on the tee for the little kid to hit it, because, what happened this past week was a lot of misinformation, a lot of conspiracy theories. Folks, this is not the show for that. We don't play around with that. We don't got time for conspiracy theories. I think the biggest thing when something like this happens, Nick, and I got a text message again from a friend who lives in the Baltimore area after this, we spoke, and she kind of echoed something to me that is kind of in that realm adjacent to it because of the boat, you know, the lights, you know, not working, the power being lost. Andrew Tate posted something on Twitter about that, saying that, you know, foreign agents of the USA are attacking our digital infrastructures. 18 million people viewed that tweet. And fortunately, or unfortunately, depending upon if you're Elon Musk, community notes, which is a way for the note connect, that's underneath the tweet to actually reflect what is true about this tweet, had said that it was misleading. But then 2 hours after Tate's note, your boy Nick, Alex Jones, Sandy Hook conspiracy theorist himself, put something up there about the bridge collapse saying that it's a cyber attack. World War III has already started. And again, the ship captain, according to reports, and he's currently, by the way, the workers of the boat are still on the boat. I don't know if people know this, like while the investigation is happening, that like they're still staying on the boat. So they didn't port, they didn't get off the boat. They didn't get off the boat while the investigation is happening because of all the debris and the wreckage that I just mentioned, the boat has nowhere to go. So they have to stay on the boat while the investigation is happening. But the captain alerted authorities, hey, I've lost power. I'm heading your way. Close the bridge. Most of the time when there's a terrorist act, they don't give you a heads up. I don't know if you know how terrorism works. So, you know, I just want for this show, we don't play with that with the conspiracy theories. Now, in the investigation process, if something comes out later on through the halls of Congress or a committee, subcommittees, whatever it is, and something does come out that says that this was related to that and there was an issue with our infrastructure, whatever it is, it was a cyber attack, whatever it was, and that is found out to be proven otherwise later on through an investigation process, we'll come back on here, Nick and I, and we'll, you know, we'll eat our words, and we'll, I'm not going to apologize to Alex Jones, but we'll eat our words and issue a retraction. But until then, right now, misinformation, disinformation, don't go spreading it. The investigation process is still ongoing. You heard from the officials there. And in the next segment, Representative Glenn Ivey is going to be joining us. We're going to talk about the bridge collapse, a little more of what is in his purview on some of the committees that he sits on in the House. Representative Glenn Ivey, when we come back after the break. Nick, today's episode is presented, as always, by our friends over at Fresh Roasted Coffee. Since 2009, their passion has always been bringing you gourmet coffees from all over the world, roasted fresh to order. I got my coffee snob here, Nick Saveri. Nick, tell these people, coffee snob it up here. Tell these people why Fresh Roasted Coffee is so good and why they're the official sponsor of Can We Please Talk?
You know, often the best cup of coffee that you're ever going to have is the one you can make from home. And you need good quality coffee to do that. And that's what Fresh Roasted Coffee offers. You know, between single origin, between blends, flavors, anything on the coffee spectrum they've got. But more importantly, and I can't stress this enough, often when you purchase coffee, you don't know where to start. I mean, there's so many different varieties, so many different opportunities, so many different things you could choose from. And Fresh Roasted Coffee just gives you a very simple questionnaire and just says, hey, figure out what your coffee cup is. Figure out what blend works for you. I've gotten some single origin recommendations, so has Mike, and that's influenced everything. And what they recommend, you can get in a Keurig cup, the way Mike takes it. You can take it in the way I do it, which is typically through a French press, or you can get it for a percolator. Whatever coffee machine you've got, they've got you covered. But more importantly, just a huge variety and a way to learn more about coffee itself.
And all of this is available at freshroastedcoffee.com on their site. One cup is all it takes to fall in love with Fresh Roasted Coffee, but you get a discount for being a listener of Can We Please Talk. Enter in the promo code Can We Please Get 20 to get 20% off your first purchase. Head to freshroastedcoffee.com today. Quick break from the pod. As always, we are presented by our friends over at SeatGeek. If you need tickets to the biggest concerts, shows, sporting events, MLB season that's starting up this coming week, you got the NBA and NHL playoffs coming up soon. SeatGeek has got you covered. Nick, did you download the SeatGeek app like I told you?
Did. We're excited to use it because we've got, obviously, the Phillies starting up this season. So I'm excited to take my girls out there and just take full advantage of the perks we get as partners.
That's right. As you should. As should our audience right now. So if you're watching or listening to this, when you download the app, put the tickets in the cart. When you hit the checkout, there's going to be a little promo code field right there.
do me a favor, enter in the promo code Can We Please Talk, all one word. You're going to get $20 off that purchase. Download the SeatGeek app or go to SeatGeek.com to get your tickets today. All right, kind enough to give us a couple of minutes here on the podcast, Congressman Glenn Ivey, representing Maryland's 4th District, joins us on the program. Congressman Mike and Nick, thank you so much for hopping on the podcast with us.
Thanks for having me.
You know, Congressman, it's good to see you again. And obviously, we set this up weeks in advance, but obviously the recent events that happened over there in Baltimore, a city that I'm very familiar with. Some of my family and friends live in that area right off of 695 and the Francis Scott Key Bridge over there. So I first wanted to get a high level before we get into some other stuff, some more congressional news and notes with you. Your initial takeaways on what has happened so far with the bridge collapse. I know the search and rescue efforts now have pivoted in terms of recovering some of the bodies there. And I believe it was 6 workers or so. But what are some of the things that you're hearing from the early onset of the investigation and your overall thoughts of, you know, the accident that happened, the warning signals, all of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think I guess at this point, everybody sort of heard the basics about it. The stuff I'm kind of curious as to how it plays out will be the NTSB investigation. There's some aspects. They got the black box, but apparently there's a longer term black box that they need to take a look at and try and get information from that. And I know they're going to be careful about releasing information as they go, because, you know, that's not the best way to do an investigation. You usually try and collect it as much as you can and then release it. But, you know, that's going to be important to see kind of what happened there. The other pieces are, you know, the absence of redundancy, you know, so the power goes out, and it seemed like the crew recognized that, but really didn't have anything that they could do to avoid the crash, and the collapse of the bridge. And that seems to be a bit strange to me, especially since apparently that ship had some kind of issues previously. And so you'd think that there'd be some sorts of efforts to have a plan B in place in the event that something like that happened. Another level of issues has come up with respect to the structure of the bridge itself. I'm hearing conflicting things. Some people are saying the barge is just so big and it had, I think it was like 96, you know, 1,000 tons on it or something. So a hit from something that big and that heavy would have taken any bridge out. But then I started hearing that, well, you know, there are some bridges that have been built that are able to sustain those sorts of collisions. And I don't really know which is true. But I think if, you know, one way or the other, the United States needs to figure that out. And then the last one was sort of an absence of, you know, tugboats. I'm not much on the shipping industry front, but, you know, again, if the ship loses the ability to steer itself or needs a little help, especially since the gap between the pillars there that held up the bridge didn't seem to be that wide. I guess the bridge is 50 years old roughly, and the ships were probably a lot smaller than they were than they are now. Shouldn't we have something, whether it's tugboats or some other sort of way to assist the boat to make sure it's heading in the right direction and can thread that needle? And I would assume too, in the future, when you build these bridges, those pillars are going to be farther apart than they were here, or they'll find some other way to go about it. But those seem to be kind of the intermediate and long-term issues. You know, the short-term issue was getting the port back open. It's different numbers, 10,000 to 15,000 jobs, $10 to $15 million per day that the port generates as an economic engine for the region. Getting that back up and running, I think, is going to be critical. And I don't know how soon that can happen, but hopefully it'll happen relatively quickly.
Representative, as you were talking about the role of the U.S., you know, being involved in the investigation, figure out what's going on and next steps, part of that short-term focus, of course, is funding. What talk has there been currently in the House as far as the role that the federal government will play in paying?
Well, we're in recess. So, you know, there's not as much as you would normally run into, say, for example, during committee meetings or floor votes. And unfortunately, there's another week to go where we continue to be on recess. But I know there have been preliminary conversations at two levels. One's with the administration. And, you know, Chris Van Hollen, one of the senators here for Maryland, who also is a cardinal on the Appropriations Committee in the Senate, you know, has already had conversations with Secretary Buttigieg. They have a fund, an emergency fund that they're going to tap into to help us deal with the front end of this and help to get some of this process started. The president made the commitment in a speech. I think it was the same day of, well, the next morning of the collision, that basically committed the federal resources to make that happen. And, you know, I know there are going to be Republicans who try and play games with this stuff. And I'm reminded of, I believe it was Governor DeSantis who, you know, opposed aid to, I think it was New Jersey during Sandy. And then he became governor. And guess what? Florida got hit by a hurricane. And all of a sudden he came to Washington with his hat in his hand. And Biden was kind enough to go and sort of pretend like that had never happened. But, you know, as my mother used to say, the chances go round. And this is one of those scenarios where, especially these days, as storms and disasters seem to be picking up their pace and their strength, I think people ought to be very, very careful about casting aspersions on us getting aid, because there's a very good chance that their state's going to need it pretty soon, too.
Well, staying on that, Congressman, you just mentioned you guys are on recess, and obviously over the last couple of weeks, a recent spending package to keep the government open was passed. I want to ask you a couple of questions on that. Just your overall impressions of this finally getting passed. It felt like forever we were kicking the can down the road of these CRs and signing this 45 days. And as we're covering this, it felt like, is there going to be a government shutdown looming? But Congress, with the House and the Senate, were able to pass this. So just some of your overall impressions of finally getting this ball over the end zone line, to, you know, lack of a better phrase here. But then also on the flip side, now, as you guys are in recess, there's already been a Republican member of Congress, and Marjorie Taylor Greene, who said she may file this motion to oust the current Speaker of the House. So give me some of your thoughts on both of those.
Well, I think, you know, the focus on the at the moment is on Speaker Johnson and his learning curve. You know, I think he saw what happened with McCarthy. You know, McCarthy reached a deal with the Democrats and the motion to vacate. I think Matt Gaetz filed that, came almost immediately thereafter. And Democrats joined with a handful of Republicans in voting him out. I think Johnson took that message to be that he was going to have to try and stick with the Republicans and continue to work things out that way. But that was the wrong lesson. What really happened with McCarthy was Democrats turned on him because he turned on us. So, you know, we delivered the votes to pass that legislation, even though he wasn't even close to getting there to get it done. And then the next day, that happened on a Saturday, the next day on Sunday, he went on the national talk shows and attacked the Democrats for trying to shut down the government. And we know he didn't misspeak, because Elise Stefanik, who was another one of the leadership people, was speaking the same talking points on another channel at the same time. So we viewed that as bad faith and flat out dishonesty. And there'd been other things leading up to that, too. You know, for example, before that vote, he never had any conversation with Hakeem Jeffries, who's the Democratic leader. He just sort of brought it to the floor and sprang it on us. And so we thought, you know what? I think we can do better than this. And we want to send a message to the Republicans that, yeah, we're willing to work with you, but you need to work with us as well. So McCarthy got the hook. Johnson comes in, tries to go it alone. I think realized pretty quickly that that was going to be hard to do, because the Freedom Caucus, that group of 30 to 40 ultra conservative members who, you know, they're not trying to just for a do nothing Congress. They want to don't do want to do nothing Congress to be the order of the day. And so he tried to appease them in a couple different ways over a couple of these short term votes. And I think came to realize that it just wasn't going to happen. So he reached out to Hakeem Jeffries. Didn't wait till the 11th hour for a change. We got the bill done. It was still close to the finish line, but, you know, we were able to get it done relatively quickly. And then the Senate moved quickly as well. So I think moving forward, Johnson recognizes that the only things that have actually gotten done in this Congress have been done when he worked with Hakeem Jeffries and the Democrats to get them done. All of those government shutdown votes, avoiding the government shutdown, those were done with Democratic votes. Not defaulting on our debt, that was done with Democratic votes. If he wants to move forward, he's going to need Democratic votes. And I think he's going to, you know, be willing to do that moving forward now. And on the motion to vacate, I think that'll be the same deal. Marjorie Taylor Greene, I think, kind of filed that. And I don't know if, you know, it's just rash behavior on her part, or if she filed something and got the word that this might not be the best way to go from her Republican colleagues, because you had the 15 votes to get McCarthy in to start with. It lasted over like 5 days. Then when they ousted McCarthy, it took 3+ weeks before they finally landed on Johnson. And they went through, I can't even remember how many, 3, 4, 5 different people. So they've been the picture of dysfunction. They look like the Keystone Cops, and they have been. I think Johnson's kind of figured out that if he wants to try and get away from that kind of look, he needs to work with us and move forward on a bipartisan basis. And that'll include the motion to vacate.
Representative, as you were talking about, and you, I think you just spoke to the cause of this, but you know, Mike and I have been doing this show for about soon to be four years now. You know, we've seen numerous resolutions that have come through for spending, but they tend to be very short term. You know, we're basically going from getting a deadline in, you know, 1 month to a few months later coming back together to get a deadline for spending. You know, and just from where you stand, you know, how can Congress do a better job of coming up with a more prolonged plan to ensure that there is an ongoing plan for government spending to make sure that all the people at the end of the day that are benefiting from federal dollars are regularly seeing it, and that we're not keep coming to the 11th hour?
Well, let's sort of amend that comment. I mean, this isn't Congress doing better. This is House Republicans doing better, because Democrats have been ready to go and the Senate's been ready to go too, and certainly the White House. And most of the spending proposals were floated well in advance. I mean, the first White House budget came out in, like, I want to say March, if I recall correctly. So this is Leader Johnson and the House Republicans really figuring out what kind of legislators they want to be. Are they really trying to get things done, or are they, you know, going to continue to play games? And some of that stuff isn't just the partisanship, although a lot of it is. They seem to really be stuck on not doing anything unless there's an angle for attacking the Biden administration. But you've also got some bills, like take FISA, for example. There are bipartisan splits on that. You've got two committee chairs from the Intelligence Committee and the Judiciary Committee who are at loggerheads on this. Johnson tried to bring them to the floor, and it did the interesting tactic of bringing them both to the floor at the same time. And of course, that didn't work. So he had to pull them down, you know, and we still haven't gotten anything resolved on those. You know, I don't know. I just think it's one of those where, you know, maybe you put your chairs together and the speaker sits down with them. You try and work your way through it. I've recommended a variation of that to the Democratic side of that as well. You know, let's see if we can have briefings and talk through whatever the differences are. But let's get everybody in the room and work it through. Just like, you know, the old days. And by old days, I mean last Congress, when Pelosi was the speaker, we had legislation flying out and you know, record amounts of it. This is probably more came out than maybe since LBJ. And it was consequential legislation too. You know, the infrastructure bill, thank God that passed. And, you know, it may turn into something that's relevant, not just for our situation in Baltimore, but for other matters going forward. You know, and then pharmaceuticals, you could do a whole show just on what was passed in that Congress, and rightly so. But I think the House Republicans, and Johnson in particular, really need to figure out if they're ready to move forward in a bipartisan way and get things done or not.
Well, I want to stay on a bill that just actually passed the other day. And I know that you're on the subcommittee around the internet and IP, and it was around the TikTok bill and this forcing ByteDance to divest or sell its shares I want to get your thoughts because we just had Representative Jasmine Crockett on a couple episodes ago, and I know she voted president. She explained why with regards to, obviously, there's concerns around data collection and privacy and what the Chinese government has access to with ByteDance as one of their companies that works in and operates in China. But then she also explained why she was present because of some of the constitutionality of it. So I would love to get your thoughts at a high level about the bill itself passing now. It goes to the Senate. Do you think it'll pass in the Senate? What'd you make of the legislation when it got handed to you? And what's your overall thoughts on TikTok and ByteDance as well?
Well, I guess there's sort of two sets of thoughts on that. One is, I think, you know, we've got some problems with TikTok, but some of those are common to all social media platforms. So singling them out raises some concerns, especially on the privacy front. You know, with respect to the China piece, which I, you know, was, I think, motivating for me, I think it's a real issue that we have to be very careful about. And so I was willing to move forward with that on those grounds. One big caveat, though, that I had at that time and still do, it's not an automatic ban on TikTok. The only issue is whether they, you know, if they can't sell the ByteDance component to the overall entity within 6 months before the ban would kick in. I'd been given assurances that they'd be able to do that. But since then, I've seen questions raised about their ability to do it. And I don't mean in a fire sale scenario either, where they're, you know, getting pennies on the dollar of what they would normally get in a regular auction. They should get, you know, fair market value. The shareholders in those companies or, you know, they shouldn't get short shrift. You know, if we're going to make them sell it, then let's make them do it in the right way. Now, is that more than 6 months? Is that, you know, a year? Do you need some sort of, you know, safety valve measures to help help them avoid any kind of unfair market consequences? Maybe. I'd be open to all of those. On the constitutional issue, I don't really see those as constitutional issues. The information going from the United States to China, China doesn't have First Amendment rights of those type, not only on TikTok, but really on anything. So I don't see the constitutional problem there at all. But with respect to what the Senate's going to do, I'm not sure. I hope they'll, you know, improve the bill. It kind of popped up and moved through the House on a relatively short order. You know, we had some subcommittee hearings on it, but not a full committee hearing that I'm aware of. And this is one of those where the consequences, this is multi-billion dollar, maybe trillion dollar industry at this point, we ought to be giving it some thought. And I know the Energy and Commerce Committee had hearings on the privacy aspect. But, you know, I think we should be very thoughtful in how we move forward with these. And that might require a little more time than it was given in this round.
You know, Congressman, let's talk about legislation that didn't pass or didn't even make it to the House. And that's around immigration. If you can't tell by my face, I'm a son of immigrants. So is Nick. Very important issue to us. And, you know, in all jokes aside, if you look at the folks that passed away in this bridge collapse, they happen to be from the Triangle countries in Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras. So right. Immigration is a huge issue right now. I know you sit on a subcommittee around Homeland Security. I want to get your thoughts about, first and foremost, the Senate bill that never made it, what that could have actually have done. CBP and the Border Patrol Agents Union have said that they need help. They're understaffed. They're overwhelmed, right? So this is actually an issue without obviously placating to the talking points of different networks. And we all know what that means. But can you kind of outline a little bit more of, like, what do you think needs to happen from a legislative standpoint right now? As you guys are in recess and you come back, we look to this issue because we know that the Republican side, and there's been reports of former President Trump saying we can campaign on this issue. That's not the way to obviously address it. So what does Congress need to do? What can Congress do right now? Or what's the chatter around some legislation that could be put together framework wise before we get to a pivotal election in November around immigration?
Well, this is another one at Speaker Johnson's feet, or on his desk, maybe I should say. You know, the Senate had a bipartisan bill. I can't say I loved it entirely. I thought there were some significant issues with respect to some of the things that it proposed. And I know on the other side, on the Republican caucus, they had concerns about it not doing enough. But my sense was that what Senator Lankford had put in there really should have been enough for what the Republicans are trying to get done, and would have been a big step in the right direction with respect to some of the legal challenges to make the process more orderly. I'm not saying build a wall and all of that stuff. That was H.R. 2, the bill that the McCarthy pushed through. But that was just, it was a silly piece of legislation, frankly. It contained all these poison pills and, you know, like eliminating federal funding to like NGOs that were doing basic work to, you know, keep people from dying or, you know, starving in the United States. And I, you know, that was just crazy. So that's why the Senate, McConnell and, you know, the Democrats said that's DOA and started from scratch with the Lankford bill. My hope is that the House Republicans will kind of come around bring it to the floor, bring it through committee, give us a chance to amend it if we want. But let's have some up or down votes on amendments and the overall bill. Because everybody agrees that something needs to happen on the border. It's just too much bad going on at all at once. And some of it is, you know, too many people coming across and we're not able to keep track of them. Kids in particular is a big concern of mine. And then we want to make sure that there's still a good asylum process in place, because there are definitely scenarios where, like, for example, we're sending people back to Haiti right now. And that's hard for me to understand, you know, how we could be sending people back to Haiti under almost any circumstances. I don't care who they are. So I think we have to work through those. The resources piece, there is legislation in the bill, the $1.2 trillion spending bill, that did provide some additional funding for that. More Border Patrol agents. I think we need more of these asylum officers and more judges to try and expedite those pieces of the process. But I think more funding is going to be needed. So my hope is that we'll try and move forward with the bipartisan Senate bill. But it looks like, you know, Trump's directive to House Republicans to not give the bill any daylight is going to carry the day, at least in the House Republican caucus, unfortunately.
Representative, I saw when I was prepping for the interview today, I saw on your website just a reference to the Raise the Age Act. That you're moving forward with. I said earlier that, you know, one topic that comes up a lot on our show is about, you know, the CR for, you know, federal spending, and it comes up repeatedly. But higher on that list, or what we talk about more, unfortunately, are mass shootings. Yeah. If you don't mind, just take us through the act a little bit. Obviously, for anyone paying attention, that's going to be a very tough hill to climb in the House. But just aspirationally speaking, what are your hopes with the bill, and what motivates you to bring it forward?
Well, you know, we took a look at sort of what the state of the laws are right now, and saw that to buy handguns, for example, if you buy a Tech 9 or something, you need to be 21. And for some reason, you can be 18 and buy an assault weapon. So we thought, let's raise the age to 21 so it at least matches with the handgun requirement. And I didn't think that was going to be a super controversial approach, since it fits with current law and really only goes to the mass killing sort of scenarios that you just referenced. To my surprise, we've gotten zero Republican co-sponsors. And I think we have like 160 or so Democrats who co-sponsored it, but no Republicans are willing to cross the line and join with us. And it's not just on my bill. You've got, you know, some things that are really no-brainers, like ghost guns, for example. And everybody knows that ghost guns are only used for crime. I mean, the only reason you care about whether your gun has a serial number or not is if you're about to commit a crime and you don't want it to trace back to you. Otherwise, there's no problem having a serial number on it. No Republican co-sponsors on that bill. Assault weapons ban, I think it makes sense. But I think we knew, we the Democrats knew going in that there's going to be a real challenge in getting Republicans to co-sponsor that. And then you just saw Glenn Youngkin, the governor of Virginia. This is state law, but he vetoed a lot of key bills that had passed through the Virginia legislature, which is, you know, not exactly a deep blue legislature by any stretch. And he vetoed several of those bills. I think NRA kind of, you know, concerns maybe on his part, but that's clearly carrying the day in the House Republican caucus. And then the last part of these issues is the Supreme Court. A few years ago, they issued the Bruin ruling, which changed the way you could, you know, the constitutional standard for reviewing gun laws, and took out any sort of consideration about whether the government was doing something that made sense and there was a rational basis for it, and just left in place a standard of historical antecedent. Were they doing this in 1791 or not? And if they weren't doing it in 1791, Justice Thomas made it sound like, they're going to strike it down as unconstitutional. So that means that a lot of bills, laws actually that are in place around the country. I know there's domestic violence laws, for example. If an abuser is charged and the court takes his guns away until the trial happens, that's up for challenge in the courts right now. And under the Justice Thomas standard, since there was no such thing as domestic violence in 1791, in fact, you know, in some circles, you were supposed to beat your wife or your girlfriend or your kids or whatever. So yeah, that's a law that could disappear and really blow a big hole in basic domestic violence protections around the country. So the gun issue is a big one. And, you know, I think we're going to have some real challenges with that going forward. I did just the last point on that. The Biden administration set up an Office of Gun Violence Reduction a few months ago, which I thought was a big step in the right direction and helpful to states like mine, my county and my state, where we're trying to find ways to reduce gun violence, you know, give us additional funds for programs that are data-driven solutions to gun violence and ways to reduce it. Because it's not just, it's not just mass assaults. We've got the day-to-day gun violence we need to deal with at the street level. And then suicides is another big piece. So we're losing thousands of lives every year to gun violence. Our Republican colleagues don't seem to have much interest in trying to find any ways to address any of those issues at any level. And I don't know what it's going to take to move them on that. But I think as Democrats, we have to keep trying.
Have to keep trying. Very well said. I like that part there for sure. Representative Ivey, we can't thank you enough for hopping on the program, giving us a couple minutes. Continued success to you, sir. And please stay safe.
Thank you. And keep up the great work. You guys are doing a wonderful service for the American people.
This episode is brought to you by KitCaster. KitCaster books you on top podcasts. How do funded startup founders attract prospects and talent? Podcast interviews. How do entrepreneurs with exits find new deals? Podcast interviews. How do C-suite execs differentiate in crowded markets? Podcast interviews. KitCaster books you on top podcasts. Click the link in the show notes for a special offer. Celebrate good conversation.
All right, our thank yous there to Representative Glenn Ivey, state of Maryland. A lot of good stuff there, Nick. Overall impressions for you, just another member of Congress coming on this show. You and I can take the proverbial lap, and what he said there at the end about doing a service for the American people. I mean, geez, now my ego can't fit through a door, but there was some good stuff in there because, you know, he sits on a few different committees, obviously Homeland Security. So with the immigration stuff, and then kind of apropos and what we talked about in our first segment with the bridge collapse, there's a lot to this because, you know, it's a major port. Transportation, there's an investigation going on. There's conspiracy theories going on all over the place, like we talked about in the first segment. So what were some of your impressions there of the congressman?
Yeah, you know, similar to, you know, other members of Congress we've had on. Yeah, I Jasmine Crockett, Representative Jasmine Crockett comes to mind. You know, there's still that frustration about trying to do good work in a Congress where that's just simply not the case. This is the second time we've had on a member of Congress who acknowledges that they will go down currently, historically, as the least successful or if you measure success by getting, you know, bills passed, you're probably the least successful Congress in memory. And you could just sense that frustration. You know, a couple of times during the conversation, he brought up, you know, some of the whys, you know, some of the questions you and I brought up as to like, why are things stalling? What's going on? And he would just simply point to the Republicans, fair or unfair, whatever you want to call that. But that's the reality. That's the perception of, you know, these members of Congress of what's getting in the way of getting anything done. And so that was very telling.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. They are going to go down in history. I mean, again, they still got, you know, 8 or 9 months. We'll see what happens over the next, you know, few months before November elections. If there's anything that could be passed, Congress is coming back next week. So they'll be out of recess and we'll see what's on the docket for Speaker Johnson and the rest of the House. Our thank yous again to Representative Glenn Ivey. If you want to check out the video portion of our interview with him, head over to our YouTube channel, type in Can We Please Talk Podcast. We should pop right up. Audio podcast platforms, you know by now, Apple, Spotify, Google, Good Pods, YouTube Music, CastBox, Downcast, Pocket Cast. I think I made up the last two, but listen wherever you get your podcast. We can't do it without each and every one of you that listens into this program. As always, I am Mike Leon.
And I'm Nick Saveri.
We'll see everybody next time.